Hello and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. Today we are again revisiting a conversation I had earlier this year, this time with Scott Gale, who passed away 2 weeks ago after a years-long battle with cancer. Anyone who knew Scott can attest to his passion for Houston, for the energy transition, and for progress as a community. As executive director of Halliburton Labs, he was instrumental in the program's success across the past 4 years. As a human, he leaves a legacy of innovation, collaboration, and curiosity, all of which we touched on in our conversation. Scott was a unique force and an extremely kind and thoughtful individual, which I think you can wholeheartedly tell from our episode where we discussed Halliburton Labs, his career, and the inaugural Houston Energy and Climate Startup Week, which Scott had a major role in creating. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to attend that week as he had already entered hospice care. You can read more about the impact Scott had in the article I wrote on his passing. I've linked it in the show notes. And I hope you'll join me in listening to this episode and remembering Scott. Next month at the Houston Innovation Awards on November 14th, we will be honoring Scott with the Trailblazer Legacy Award. I've also linked more information on the award. Onward is what Scott would say, both to the episode and to more growth and progress as an energy innovation community. Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Natalie, thrilled to be here.
Well, you are one of those people who is just so much more than their title, and I'm excited to talk to you because we've had a lot of conversations on and off the record that have been really great. So
That's
it's
right.
Great that we're finally doing it for the Houston Innovators Podcast. But yeah, you're so much more than just your title and your career. You're very involved in the Houston innovation and energy industry here in Houston. So just to start, and we can't necessarily have the full Scott Gale story, but I want to know what's really interested you in the energy industry throughout your career and kept you around both in energy and innovation.
Sure. Well, thank you for the generous comments. It's a privilege to be here. I did not grow up in Houston or in Texas. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. Grew up in a small paper mill town. The high school I went to, our mascot was the Paper Makers. And the paper mill anchored the town. You were either a lumberjack or a chemical engineer at the plant. And I chose chemical engineering. That led me into petrochemicals, which ultimately brought me to Houston. And pretty quickly kind of fell in love with the idea of what energy means for like quality of life for humanity. And this was kind of at the real early end of the hydraulic fracturing boom in North America. And I made a decision kind of in the late aughts to sort of get closer to the wellhead. And so made a few career decisions that I thought were pointed in that direction. And that led me to Halliburton in 2014. So I'm working on year 10 at Halliburton and was in a corporate strategy role, thinking about the hydraulic fracturing business at Halliburton, continued to reinforce, I think, this idea of kind of energy independence and the role of what technology could do to create a whole bunch of opportunity for people around the world. And, you know, in 2020, I got the call to do this Halliburton Labs thing. And before it was even called Halliburton Labs, and I'd been thinking about entrepreneurship and always thought of myself as like someone who thought about the sort of the optimistic lens of like what the world could be and like the idea of building things and being kind of dissatisfied, if you will, with sort of how things are done. And so trying to find a better way. And I think the now 4 years into Halliburton Labs, it's just been a really cool opportunity to spend time with entrepreneurs and get closer to sort of the ecosystem generally here in Houston, but also spent a lot of time looking for companies around the world. And so it's been like a really cool way to spend my time. So like that quick, like flyby, I guess, is sort of like how I got here and where I came from. I've always sort of had this want to understand how the world works kind of mentality. If you asked me when I was a little kid, what I wanted to be when I grew up, my answer was always an inventor. And I didn't really know what that like meant. I just liked to create things and do things. And I sort of went down the engineering path to sort of learn how the world works from a physics and kind of chemistry standpoint. So that's sort of found ways to do that in big established companies, and just found a deep respect for what the entrepreneur persona is and does. And I'm adjacent to that, I like to think. I don't think I quite have all those qualities, but certainly love and appreciate sort of what entrepreneurship is and does.
I feel in a similar situation where I'm in the world of entrepreneurship without being, you know, directly an entrepreneur, probably even less so than your capacity. But it is great to hear everybody's stories and everything. And I think something that really stands out for me is how you have this desire to see how the world works. And I think something I take for granted as a native Houstonian, where the energy world is so closely tied with the culture here in Houston, is that a lot of people don't understand the massive industry that is the energy sector and how much it plays into how the world works without us even knowing it. So this like all lines up with kind of your brand, I will say.
Sure.
But with Halliburton Labs, I think something that I've learned over time, because I remember writing that first story about Halliburton Labs launching and having no clue what it really means to drive innovation and sustainability at a corporate level. And now I feel like we see so many different energy companies doing different things, but like kind of bucketed to being like all the same, like, oh, here's this venture arm that Chevron has launched, and here's this, you know, accelerator program that so-and-so has launched. Everyone's doing something in that world of innovation and energy transition, it seems, but they're doing it so differently. So I guess that's a long roundabout way of asking you to kind of explain the mission of Halliburton Labs and how it is different from what's out there.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to do that without first talking about the importance of strategy. And that sounds super boring. I've spent a lot of my time sort of thinking about the principles of strategy. And to borrow an analogy from Halliburton's CEO, which I've heard him articulate a bunch of times, which resonates really strongly with me, is strategy is like music. Music is all around us. There are rules to music. And some of the best music is when, like, practitioners selectively break the rules. And like masterfully break the rules. And I think that strategy, like real, like Michael Porter's corporate, like deep strategy principles, are a really nuanced skill set in the business world. I think when we think about big corporates and working towards shareholder returns and all these things, these are very quantitative finance accounting kinds of skill sets. And strategy is really nebulous in a bunch of ways. And we use these really simplified terms of value propositions and, you know, these stated mandates and these things. But what I have found is there's this subtlety and importance in contextualizing what strategy actually means. But it's this integrated set of activities that an organization does day in and day out that drives long-term sustainable competitive advantage relative to other people that are doing whatever the activity set is. So you can pick Southwest Airlines or IKEA for furniture or Tesla for, you know, vehicles. Like, all of that activity set is really important to understand who you are as an organization and what, like, is the heartbeat and like the profit generating set of activities. And I think what made Halliburton Labs really special or unique and in the way that it is I think it was rooted in good strategy and an understanding and a recognition of what is unique to Halliburton. And we were quite deliberate about what is the environment that we're building, not as a bolt-on, not as some, you know, some activity or some environment that is, you know, serve some purpose, but that it was an extension of sort of the culture and the personality and the strategy of the organization. And I think that's really important because it's in some ways, I've actually been surprised that now, 3-4 years later, there haven't been sort of more Halliburton Labs-esque models being rolled out. And I think in part because there's a few guiding principles that are really hard for corporates to sort of get to. And you may have heard me or colleagues at Halliburton Labs say this, but our founding principles are three things. Founders first, giving before you get, and learning by doing. And in a lot of ways, those are like deliberately kind of not corporate personality traits. You know, this idea of putting a founder or an entrepreneur first. And like, what does that really mean in like your day to day? Big companies, publicly traded companies, you've got quarterly returns, you've got shareholder expectations, all these things. And the right answer when you grow up in corporates, and I've spent my whole career, Halliburton's the youngest company that I've worked for in my career. It's, you hear that mantra all the time. Like, you're solving for shareholder returns. Like, what's the ROI on that? What's that look like? And so you develop and build all of these skill sets around, okay, if we're going to invest in a thing, we're going to deploy capital, or we're going to hire people to work on this problem. There's always a spreadsheet that goes along with it and projects what the ROI and the net present value of the opportunity is. And you're forced to make trade-offs about where that goes. But there's always this idea of having line of sight to the outcomes. And when you're interfacing with the sort of startup community and you are investing in the startup community, or you're expecting to derive some kind of value from interfacing with the startup community, you don't have the benefit of line of sight. A lot of the things that are being solved for are just too early stage. And that can be really hard for corporates to wrap their heads around, because it's like, well, where do I invest? How do I spend time? Is it worth doing that? And I think one of the things that we got to was this idea that you could invest in the startup community. You don't know where the returns are going to come from, but you know that they'll come. And so it requires a bit of a longer run horizon. If you look at some of the work that Brad Feld has put out there, I think his book, The Startup Community Way, you know, I don't get any royalties or anything from it. I'm just a rabid fan. I think that book came out late summer of 2020, shortly after we had kind of stood up Halliburton Labs. And some of the frameworks that are sort of discussed there are quite important. He talks about having a 20-year time horizon. Thinking about things on a rolling 20-year time horizon is super tough for corporates to do. But I think that if you're clear about your identity, who you are, how you interface, and what are some of the unique things that you can bring to the community, I think doing that in a way that supports entrepreneurs has created a bunch of, for lack of better terms, serendipity for kind of where things have gone to. So that's probably the most detailed description that I've given on that. But I do think that like a lot of discussion about strategy, understanding who you are. And then, you know, there was a real deliberate effort to talk about what is innovation? Where does it come from? How is that, you know, what's the spark of it? It's actually one of the reasons why Walter Isaacson is on our advisory board, because we had early conversations with him as someone who is an author talking about innovators and communities. You know, his book about Leonardo da Vinci talks about the Medici family and the environment in Italy in the whatever 1400s, 1500s, and like what led to this like Renaissance kinds of activities. There's a bunch of parallels you can draw to today. We looked at the Idea Factory, which looked at Bell Labs and some of the, you know, Xerox Park and these places where ideas, sort of this fertile ground for ideas to be shared and generated, and what could that look like in, at the time, 2020, and here now 2024, like what are the pieces that are needed? And so I think that coming about it that way helped to have the right sort of founding principles for us and our organization versus like, hey, we got to be seen working with startups. Let's go be seen working with startups.
Yeah, right. Like that box checking approach versus like really ingratiating Halliburton into the community. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that community first kind of mindset, I would say. But maybe just briefly, if you could talk a little bit about, because I know examples are really great, talk a little bit about Nanotech, because that is a company, obviously, Innovation Map readers and listeners of this podcast know pretty well. And so that was Halliburton Labs' inaugural startup. And how did that company, like why that company, why that technology, and how has Halliburton and Nanotech forged out that relationship?
Yeah. Hey, Mike. Yeah, maybe a few things and trying to think about maybe something that I haven't really touched on in the past. Not a lot of people know that when we launched, we intended to launch with three companies. And our third principle in learning by doing was two of the other companies. At the time, if you can appreciate, we were trying to establish what the boundary condition would be for the what the companies would be working on relative to the run rate business. And one of the challenges that you have to sort out is how do you think about IP? And two really interesting companies, probably not fair to share their names sort of publicly because it never sort of came out, but you would recognize them. And I've been really bummed that we didn't sort of get them in the boat, but some of the things they were doing were subsurface. And they were just too, we were too early in the process to feel comfortable about that boundary condition. And so one of the things about Nanotech is it was just so far afield from what Halliburton do as a part of their run rate business that it was really easy for that particular sort of metric. There were many others that we were looking at, but that particular metric was interesting. And it was actually so far afield, it was a little bit of a stretch. Like we were like, is this really like a future energy thing? Like, what do we mean when we're sort of like looking beyond the fence line of Halliburton? Are there things that we could do to be helpful? But when you're, there's sort of some guiding principles in evaluating early stage companies and really three big broad buckets. The first is there a big market? You know, what's the market potential? The second is, can the technology scale? And what's the business model to scale it? And then the third is the founding team. And so all of those things kind of have to look pretty good at that early stage. And I mean, this was real early. They were batch mixing. You've heard them tell the story, you know, a brewery tank in their driveway. You know, they were getting calls from the HOA, complaints of, you know, their white powder in the driveway and everything. And they were cooking it in their ovens and, you know, poor Jarvis probably, you know, had to like redo his kitchen and stuff after what they had done. And so, you know, these guys were really early, but there was a relationship there. Mike and I have known each other for a bunch of years. And frankly, I had called him just to kind of say like, hey, we're trying to do this thing with entrepreneurs. You left Halliburton, you know, a bunch of years ago to go start companies. Like, just tell me about like what has to be true for entrepreneurs to even think about spending time with Halliburton, you know? This was all like very like conceptual. And he was like, well, you know, we're doing this thing. They had like maybe stood up their company like 6 months before. It was like, we've got the ambition to be a company. I was like, we've got the ambition to be an accelerator. Let's do this together and see kind of what comes of it. And so, you know, they took a big risk in sort of having that transaction with us. But I think what played out is that Mike's a great founder. Like Mike is someone that you would bet on. Doesn't really matter like what the technology is. And so I think we were fortunate in that sense. And, you know, we're thrilled now here, you know, they've been occupying something like 8,000 square feet of manufacturing space on Halliburton's campus for the last couple of years. They're actually moving out now here and moving into their own space. And that's like this among many like awesome milestones to sort of see them kind of take that forward. And, you know, Nanotech gets a lot of airtime. We've got 32 portfolio companies now all around the world, Singapore, India, Finland, UK, and all the time zones in the US, Canada. And I think what we found is that Halliburton have like capabilities in manufacturing and design and supply chain and thinking about health and safety regulations, permitting, expanding into new markets, country entry. You know, these are skill sets that as an established, you know, now 105-year-old company, we've got a lot of capability in-house that we figured out a way to kind of deploy on behalf of these companies and helps to, I've always said, this industrial wrapper around a startup. I think a challenge when you're a five-person team, you're in a driveway, you want to sell to, you know, pick your favorite big company, Walmart or Exxon or whatever, and you want them to come check out what's going on. It's easier to do that at, say, a Halliburton campus, if that makes sense for that particular participant, than to invite them over to your house and see what you're doing in their in your garage kind of thing. So, you know, I think we couldn't be more thrilled with where kind of nanotech has gone. I think one of the challenges they had, and Michael talked about this, but, and I think one of the things we were helpful with them in the very early days, their technology was so ubiquitous. You could, anywhere there was a thermal gradient, there was an opportunity. And it was like, they had like tons of really big markets they could go chase. And they had all these shiny objects. And I remember sitting down with them and we were whiteboarding and kind of doing this strategy thing that I was talking about. And it was like, you guys need a beachhead. Like, you got to like turn on a revenue stream, because you're chasing all these certifications. You're spreading yourself thin. Like, get really focused. And you've seen a lot of the stuff in the news with what they're doing with their roof coating. And they've really found a great sort of initial market to get revenue and start scaling. And so I think that, you know, it's been a really nice, you kind of get lucky, but I think that, you know, we were deliberate about what it was we were solving for and who we were betting on.
Well, one of the things I know I like to do is claim Halliburton Labs for Houston. But what has happened recently and over the years is the growth of your reach. And I know you've even taken the demo days on the road. So maybe briefly talk a little bit about where y'all have done demo days, where you've really had secondary markets and grown in that way.
Yeah, an important sort of de-risking element for selecting companies is increasing the number of eyeballs on the opportunity. And so we've started these pitch days as like these, the on-ramp to the Halliburton Labs experience. And we started that really early in the process. I mean, the first one that we did was in December of 2020. And that was a Teams call. There was really not sophisticated. There's probably a whole episode to talk about the do's and don'ts there. That's very much a learning by doing kind of experience. But the first few were virtual, just the nature of what was going on, and then turned into a hybrid event. And after we did several of those hybrid events here in town, and yes, we were sort of scouting all over, you know, Halliburton operates in 70 plus countries around the world. And so we kind of had this concept of lots of maybe some, just to sort of cut to the chase, it was like this imagining like a college game day, like style experience. Like, we don't coordinate the football game, but we could bring the production and, you know, do some things there. And so there was kind of this, hey, what if, you know, there was a convening event focused on startups and we could bring our pitch day to that. And so we started to look out and we, through a variety of different sort of options, landed on Denver. And there was a lot about Denver that was really interesting. I joked that the Denver, kind of the greater Denver area, is kind of a loose alliance of tribes. You've got Golden and Boulder and Fort Collins and some really great energy centric organizations that are there. And it's a bit less established as a startup community in many ways than the coasts. And so we thought that that would be like an interesting thing to do. And so a long process to build kind of a coalition around this idea of a future of energy day, that was, you know, included our pitch day, but also brought several energy sort of centric organizations and universities to bring their network and to do some panels and do some events. And it was this idea of the startup community needs to convene, and curating collisions always brings some kind of serendipity. And so, as I mentioned, like increasing the number of eyeballs on the applicants and the finalists, the idea of how do you get kind of people through the door and get eyeballs on them and you know, solicit feedback, you know, we're not trying to pick winners. We don't pretend that we have all the answers about all these different markets, but if you get lots of different perspectives on the companies, there's been countless examples of opportunities or issues that have been surfaced that we didn't see at first. And so the spirit of that, but it's there's really no better way to build connective tissue with startup communities than rolling up sleeves. And, you know, I'm excited to say it's a little bit early here in February, but Future of Energy 2.0 out in Denver is going to happen again. We won't bring our pitch event to the event as a part of it, but, you know, we're going to be in New Orleans in March of 2024. And that'll be for New Orleans Entrepreneur Week. They're doing a Third Coast Venture Summit. And by showing up and like finding ways to be helpful and to, you know, chip in on a reception or to bring your network or whatever it might be, you really just build a depth of connectivity that that I think is a bit, you know, not to pick on other models, but it was something that we thought was differentiating versus, say, writing a check and having like our logo on a thing. But it was like, we really don't do that. We like to say, hey, we'll maybe if we can, we'll bring some budget, but we're going to roll up sleeves, you know, if we can be helpful from a selection committee standpoint or from a mentorship standpoint or whatever it might be. And so we'll be in New Orleans. And then I think we've built a bunch of muscles and scar tissue about building coalitions in different cities. And so, you know, been thinking about how we might be able to do that in our own backyard.
Yeah, well, that segues very nicely into what is the why now that we're talking. And it's because the news of the Houston Energy and Climate Startup Week 2024, which I remember you talking about the idea of it to me, just like backstage at the Digital Wildcatters event. And I was like, yes, that should happen. And then you and your collaborators have made it happen. So tell me a little bit about the origin and kind of the purpose of this week of convening.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's a novel idea. Like, I think this idea of having like a climate week or an energy week like makes a lot of sense. You know, Houston has CERAWeek and the Agora track has a bunch of great content. And our friends at IHS Market, now S&P Global, like they do an awesome job of like bringing folks in. And we as Halliburton Labs, myself personally, have like helped to contribute to what goes on in March. And one of the challenges is like those kinds of events are restrictive to early stage companies because the ticket price is high. You know, maybe if you get an opportunity to pitch at one of the events or something like that. So like New Orleans Entrepreneur Week, that's a free event for anybody that wants to attend. There's some behind the paywall kind of bit of content. Denver Startup Week, free event. Halliburton Labs Finalist Pitch Day has always been a free event. We don't charge admission for it. We broadcast it, we record it, we put it online. And those are very deliberate decisions because like lowering the threshold for access and increasing, you know, the number of folks that can put eyeballs on it, we think is really important. And so, you know, it's kind of this idea of what has to be true for sort of something like that. Like, why hasn't it happened? It's not a novel concept, but like there's challenges and there's great examples. You know, you could look to, you know, the ones I've already mentioned, New Orleans Entrepreneur Week, Denver Startup Week. These are events that have like 10, 15 years old. Like they've been going on for some time. They've great kind of like local and regional followings. And you got some big names like South by Southwest, you know, obviously like San Francisco Climate Week. You've got Climate Week New York. London does kind of a Climate Week. And all of those are sort of structured a little bit differently. But they all sort of grew up over time. You know, like you didn't just sort of like wave a magic wand and South by Southwest exists. You know, I think there was a quote somewhere the last time I was at South by and it was like, how do you make like a South by happen? And it's like, you come up with a great idea and then you let it cook for 30 years, you know, and it was just like, so you have to sort of look back in time to say, okay, what are the initial steps that were needed? And there were really sort of two guiding principles, to make it simple, is calendar coordination and cross promotion. And, you know, South by, for example, started with a film festival that was sort of going on. they had like some startup activities that were happening. And it was just like, hey, you've got a cool event that people attend and show up for. You've got a cool event. Maybe from a calendar coordination standpoint, we get more attention and get more people showing up if we do those cool events within proximity of each other. And I think that's a really important first 2024 version hypothesis to prove out, which is if these great, you know, half day, full day events that are going to happen in 2024 anyways, if they happen in tight succession from one another, that it increases the size of the pie. More people are going to come because now it's easier to justify going to Houston for two nights or three nights or four nights versus, yeah, am I going to go out for kind of a half day thing, maybe a reception, and then I'm going to have to turn around and come back in 2 weeks. So just kind of making it easier. And then the cross promotion standpoint, I think this idea of we're all kind of collaborating anyways. So why not amplify one another's events, encourage people to attend? And then, you know, if all that turns out, then, you know, I think it's pretty easy to say, okay, well, what are the next natural steps that happen from that? And so I think we've got a really awesome, like, initial coalition. And I like to say, like, whether you're the fifth company or organization that raises their hand to do something that week or the 50th, it really doesn't matter. Like that press release that went out was a call to action to say, hey, this is a week that organizations that do events that are individually successful and well-established, we're going to do them that week. And if you have an event, or maybe you don't, you need to come up with one, do something that week. And so it really is an open invitation. And I want to make that super clear because we debated it a bunch on the back end before pushing a press release. And frankly, even debated, like, is a press release the right thing to do or whatever. I actually think that, like, it came from the Amazon approach of doing things where you start with writing a press release so that you can, like, describe to the outside world what your thing is going to be. And then as we socialized that, it was like, yeah, actually, I think it makes sense to sort of like put the ask out to the world and, you know, manifest it and, you know, encourage people to kind of rally around it. And so, you know, one of my concerns is that people might feel like, well, I wasn't included on the initial press release, or if I wasn't, that I might not. And like, that's not it at all. Like, I want to make sure it's super clear. Like, that's a call to action to say, come do something, let's coordinate. So the ION is kind of serving as a center of gravity for activity. I actually would argue that, like, it's big enough that no single center of gravity is going to exist to cover it all. So I think there's going to be grassroots efforts to coordinate around maybe subtopics on the space that are going to be quite interesting. So pick your favorite location. It doesn't have to be at the ION. The ION, the team there, is cleared the calendar that week, so there's space to be divvied out. So they'll be coordinating some things there. And that's sort of where we're at today. I think it's really super exciting. I think that this idea of celebrating entrepreneurship in and around energy and climate is a really meaningful step forward. It's not going to be without bumps and bruises. And I think, you know, people have a whole range of perspectives of like what that week could be. And I say, let's welcome them. Like, it's come one, come all. Like, the community needs to convene. There's not one single location in Houston. Heard me say before, you know, Houston is an hour outside of Houston. It's a constellation of different organizations and groups. And so whether you're at the Cannon or headquarters or Greater Houston or whatever it might be, the hope is that with the kind of a cross promotional machine of all these organizations that have raised their hand and are raising their hand, because every single day there's a new organization that's like, I want to be involved. I want to be involved. So I would just say, like, there's a ton more to come. The ION district has a sub page that you can submit some interest. There's a LinkedIn page that you can follow that, exactly as you've described it, the Energy and Climate Startup Week. And so lots more to come, but it's going to be a great week to be in Houston celebrating energy and climate entrepreneurship.
Yeah. And there's so much time between now and then for people to step up and bring their events together. So it's a great ask, and anyone listening, consider it an open invitation, right? To go to those pages and learn more. One thing I love talking to you about is this, you know, it's been a few years since there seemed to be this, like, the switch flipped and thinking about Houston as the energy capital and making it more this energy transition capital mindset. And I wonder, just kind of as we wrap up our conversation today, where are we on that mission? Like I said, it's been a few years that it's been kind of, seems like there's been an active push. And I think specifically from your perspective, from the corporate side of things, like, have corporations taken the mandate to play a role in that initiative, or is there still room for improvement in that way?
Yeah, you know, it's there's several sort of features of this that I think are have been guiding principles really from the beginning. I mean, even if you look back to some of the early talking points, at least coming out from Halliburton Labs, and those continue to be the case today, is that oil and gas broadly is going to play a meaningful role in the energy system, like my lifetime, my children's lifetime. Like, it's going to play a role. And I think there's a ton of debate out there of, like, well, is that good? Is that bad? Is it, you know, there's a, and I've been a part of every part of discussion across that whole spectrum. I was just speaking on a panel in Cairo last week on the topic of deploying trillions of dollars. What does that look like? And, like, one of the topics in many ways is, like, how do you get the oil and gas industry to a fitness level, if you will, that it is participating in this sort of net zero future? And I think that's a very sort of actionable kind of thing. I think there's a pocket of humanity that feels like that's problematic and that it should be addition by subtraction. But energy transitions, if you go back in time, have always taken, like, 80, 90, 100 years. And I think one of our challenges is there's this sense of urgency to accelerate this one to whatever that looks like. But you look at demand profile, you look at the pursuit of quality of life by humanity, there's no single energy source that's going to supply all of that, barring, like, fusion taken off. But we're always, like, 20 years away from fusion. We're closer than we've ever been, but we're still pretty far away. So it's got to be a yes and kind of thing. And so the other thing that we always talked about and continue to talk about is that the energy system of the future is going to be made up of hundreds, if not thousands, of technologies that are out there or maybe even don't exist. But it's not going to be like one or two things. It's going to be, the energy system is going to be built of a whole bunch of these. And there's going to be a need for enabling technologies, value chains that support those things. And a lot of that is undercapitalized and nascent still today. And so all of that means this is a big, long, drawn out challenge that there's, you know, you've heard this, the phrase, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. And I think that's one of the kind of guiding principles of what does it take for the energy system to exist at scale? How do you go from exciting pilot projects scattered around the world, demonstrating all these different technologies, to a fully integrated future energy system? Houston is uniquely positioned with skill sets, infrastructure, to be able to think about and solve those inevitable challenges of trying to scale these things. And so I think that, you know, even over the last 4 or 5 years, the pendulum has kind of swung. I think that especially as interest rates have done what they've done and the sort of cost of capital to deploy some of these projects, you're seeing some sort of discouraging news around projects being walked back. I think that some big energy companies swung much further out and kind of got bit by that. So there's no, like, clear right answer, but I think that pointing in the direction of solving this energy system broadly. And then the thing I like to say too, and I feel like I said it this morning, I say it last week, like, we conflate two challenges especially when we think about sort of oil and gas, if you want to talk about sort of hydrocarbons, is one is the generation of electrons and access to energy. But then there's a materials side of the challenge. So much of quality of life for humanity comes from petroleum derived products, and we're far less sort of down the path on solving some of those issues, getting to feedstocks that are meaningful, that are not derived from petroleum. And so I think it's a multi-headed challenge, but Houston is as well positioned as any geography on the planet to address the opportunities that are coming from those inevitable changes.
Yeah, it's such a great reminder of how big of a challenge it is and how much time it's going to take. And I feel like sometimes I get caught up in that where I see really cool technology and I'm like, oh, it's going to change the world. And it's so much has to happen for that.
You know, there was a woman on this panel last week from HSBC, you know, a big international bank, and they had done an estimate how much is going to need to be spent to get to a net zero future. And their estimate was $155 trillion. That's 155,000 $1 billion projects. And so it's just like, and that's probably like a conservative estimate. So when you think about like the scale of that, you know, let's celebrate the $5 million seed round and the $25 million, you know, sort of scale up kind of thing. But like, you're talking about numbers that are really significant, and there's just few places on the planet that know how to execute a $1 billion project. Houston has a density and concentration of that that's just unique.
Yeah, I love those. I don't know if they're like memes or TikToks or reels where they like actually show out wealth based off of like grains of rice, and I can't even like our brains could not even fathom that much trillions of grains of rice.
No, you can't. It's a hard number to sort of conceptualize. It's tough.
Yeah. And like I said, a great reminder. Well, Scott, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I know why. It's because you're very used to sitting on the other side of the podcast table with your podcast Curiosity, which you launched and co-host with Brad Rosacci, and I've been a guest on it. It's such a great show. So why did y'all start this podcast? What's the point of Curiosity to you and exploring that as a concept?
No, thanks. I you know, it's this like passion project that is an expression of my life's work that, you know, when Brad and I met during the pandemic, we were talking about sort of innovation and other stuff, and we very quickly got to sort of this space of sort of, especially at the time during the pandemic, like the initial spark was just like, you know, curiosity could be the antidote to a lot of like humanity's problems. Like, we just don't have the critical thinking skills that are needed to like really thrive with all the technology that's around us. And, you know, lots of conversations about the role of social media and the issues. And I mean, those are all being debated right now, honestly, with the Supreme Court and everything. And we're just sort of exploring that. And I'm, you know, a father of four kids. My oldest is a freshman in high school now, and sort of starting to see the world through their development and their eyes. And it was really this idea of like, is there a perfect question? Is there, you know, a thing that could solve a lot of this for humanity? And so we're having a lot of these philosophical debates. And I would say, so the initial spark was like, is there actually a solution to like all of this strife and difficulty and challenge? And, you know, humanity, it's just a feature of humanity. You know, there's just not prevailing peace. There's inequity. There's, you know, all of these issues and challenges. And we sort of felt like this role of curiosity, you know, what was a way to like express that? And we actually started, I don't know how many, you know, we started it as a mini series project that we were pitching to Netflix. And it was going to be like an 8-part documentary series that was sort of exploring the role of humanity in different sort of cities around the world. And very quickly, because of travel restrictions and all these other issues, it's like, man, that's going to be tough to bite off on. is there some beta or beachhead? And I texted Brad. I was like, hey, be at this address here this afternoon. He showed up. He's like, what's up? I was like, we're starting a podcast. And we sat down and we recorded and we released, actually, that's the epilogue of season one. Is the very first time like Brad and I like sat down to talk about sort of what that looks like. And that was 3-4 years ago. So the prevailing guiding feature of it is just trying this pursuit of trying to get more curiosity into my own life. And it's just been a really amazing way to meet humans that would not have had the opportunity to collide with otherwise, to hear their stories, to be inspired by life's challenges and opportunities. And I think there's just some really incredible, beautiful things that happen in quiet corners of the world that don't get as much airtime because they don't get the clicks, they don't get the likes, they don't, you know, we're a little bit of a wreck on the freeway kind of attention species. And so I think for Brad and I, we just wanted to try and contribute something that might be meaningful, tell some stories, meet some folks that were interesting. So, you know, I'm not really doing it justice. I think Brad articulates it in ways that that are meaningful. But I think for me, like, just some of my best days are when we're recording. So it's something that is a ton of fun. And yeah,
it does go back to how we started the conversation and how interested you are in how the world works. And I think that's this curiosity, this underlying thing that humans are capable of, but like you said, like, we don't necessarily explore it enough. So if you are listening and you liked this conversation with Scott, Brad's equally great, and they should definitely check out Curiosity. I think it's at the minimum such a great reminder to people to explore their own curiosity and think on how they would answer the questions y'all are asking. Sometimes I had a lot of fun with it. So
it was a blast to have you on. I mean, it was a two-parter. We talked for like 2 hours. Talked
for so long, which, you know, kind of, you know, felt in this episode too. So thank you again for joining me, Scott. It was a pleasure to catch up and really kind of explore all of the things that make up you as a person. It was fun. I feel like we probably didn't even get into your full dynamic, but
no, that's okay. Natalie, thanks for all you do for the community, and excited for what 2024 has ahead.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.